lowest ones. Oregon is a little below the national average. The national average is about 67.8%. Oregon is about 65.2%, and that's in 2001. Although Oregon comes with states that have some sort of indication of very high mobility and high business, California, New York, Hawaii, Nevada, Alaska. Of course, Texas is not sure why, but the high ownership states you would see are most like the states that have a lot more sedentary population, Indiana, Minnesota, and so on. The highest would be this time, it basically alternates between Michigan, Minnesota, and so on. They always are in the mid-70s of ownership. Now, the home ownership in the U.S. and Oregon, I thought after we saw the first slide, is basically to see how did that change through time. And I tracked it back to 1984 with the home ownership of in Oregon and in the United States. And in those columns, you would see the light blue is the United States and the dark maroon is Oregon. And you'd see the change within the time. And if you start looking at the time of the 1991, where you see the home ownership percentage in Oregon started to come down. Primarily, that is probably a function of an increased population. This percentage basically is a number of people, population, and or households, and the people who own their homes out of these households. So the more people you have that they haven't bought and established ownership yet, the lower the percentage that you would see. And that basically came to the lowest level in 1997. And you would see also the new trend of increase that not only Oregon but also that nation as a whole have been experiencing since 1997. This reflects the affordability of homes, the lower rates that people are able to do it, and so on. And I've put on the right-hand side scale the graph, the line graph basically that shows the change in Oregon population. And you see that the peak in 1991 and then increasing in not as robust of a rate as it used to be in the rest of the 90s with a slight uptick in 2001. And that, in a way, lends some explanation of how these home ownership in Oregon are happening. Now, that basically puts down the base for the property tax system, which is home ownership. And the property tax system is, in its purest form, if you will, it is a payment for services rendered. And the tax is primarily a local tax. It's a tax assessed and collected by local governments for the local services. However, one of the main characteristics of this tax on property is its stability. The tax is stable on the long term. It does not fluctuate much. And the base is basically remains stable over time. And also, what is one of the important things about our tax system here in Oregon, that it is it's a rate-based rather than a levy-based system at this point.
You want to explain that, Mazen, just the terminology for committee members, rate-based versus levy-based?
The rate-based, Mr. Chair, is basically a collection on a rate of value. So you would have, let's say, 5 per thousand, 15 per thousand. That is a rate established. The levy-based is basically where the district, let's say a school district, that needs a certain amount of money and gets their budgets and their needs and then levies a tax to fulfill their needs. And that's where the difference.
So the rate base defines the input, the levy base defines the outcome. And basically in the rate base, you get what you get.
That's correct.
When you tax at a certain rate per thousand. Levy base, you can say you're going to get this much, you're going to get $50 million, and the rate is going to be whatever it has to be to collect $50 million.
Precisely.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. And just following up on that, that is a major shift with Measure 5, isn't it? We used to be a levy-based system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernhardt, that is correct. However, also Measure 50 have played a lot of that function because it established certain rates. And coming through, I will go into more details with Measure 5 and Measure 50 and what they did to the system as a whole.
Yeah, Representative Bridger.
I just want to go back to that first one where it's the logic in basing it on property, the tax itself on property. For instance, within the city of Coos Bay, the property taxes pay a little less than what it costs for public safety, both fire and police. So the property owners are paying the tax, but all the people in the community must be protected by public safety. So I think there's some people wonder why we have connected property taxes to services. And I think that we need to have a very clear, the public needs to have a clear understanding of exactly how that is connected.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, as in most tax systems, there is no 100% proof perfect system, if you will. That is one-for-one relationship between services and taxes. However, there are things that come close, if you will, and this is probably one of them that comes close. If you're thinking about people who rent, for example, rent in a way also pays property tax through the rent payment that filters through in the property tax and so on. So there is some certain logic into it, whether it is the absolute truth or what it should be, that, of course, always remains as a discussion.
Mr. Chair, the comment that I'd like to make is I agree with you, but I think there is a disconnect sometimes between people who own property and they feel that they are bearing the lion's share. And you're absolutely right. If you rent, part of that goes, and then the property owner is paying the tax. So.
In this slide, I thought it's probably an important thing to look at what we call the tax burden, or what and how we pay for the property tax. And those are two measures of that payment. One measures the property tax as a percent of personal income. This is the aggregate level personal income in Oregon. And the line which goes with the right-hand scale with the dollars is a property tax per capita. That's for every man, woman, and child in Oregon. As you see, since the beginning of the 90s, property taxes as part of personal income has been coming down. It was at a certain point in the 1982 at 5.09, or almost 5.1% of personal income. By the time we're looking at Measure 50, you're looking at about 2.98% of personal income. And at this point, in the year 2001-2002, the year that just passed, it's about 3.29% of personal income. So it has stayed steady and stable on personal income percentage in the last 10 years or so after it came through the decline in the early 90s. Also, the same decline appears in the property tax per capita, It started declining about the same time. However, before that, it was increasing much faster, as you see in the 70s and 80s. And then it started going back, and at this point, per capita is about $900 and some. That's about the same amount paid per capita as it was paid in the 1991 or so. And of course, all these numbers are not adjusted for inflation. So you know that the dollars in 1974 probably bought a lot more services at that time with lower amounts of dollars than they do now. And as that previous slide comes and we see the decrease, I thought it's important to see how we rank also around, or against the nation. Where do we rank in both of these categories, as percent of income and per capita? Keep in mind that if you're number one, you're the highest paying, or the highest tax. You see that in 1982-83 time, we were about 9th in percent of income and 13th in per capita. And we kept going up, and we were some of the highest states all through the 80s. And, you know, then you get to about start the decline. About the 91, that's when Measure 5 came in and started putting a cap on property taxes. And the rank keeps going up, especially even after Measure 50 in 97. At this point, we're the 25th, and this is as of the year 2000, because the statistics for the rest of the nation is not available beyond that year. 25th as percent of income, and the 29th as per capita. And that means we're just right in the middle of the pack, basically. Now, this is an interesting look of how property values and tax rates have changed through time since the 1970s until the year 2001. And on the line that you would see with big black boxes, that's where the tax rate, basically, and it goes on the right-hand scale. So the right-hand scale with 0, 5, 10, 15, that represents dollars per thousand. So in 1970, we were about $27-$28 per thousand of value. The bottom lines would represent assessed value and market value. And you see that they were very hugging, basically, for most of the time, until the time of Measure 50 came in, when there was a separation between market value and assessed value. You see that market value continues climbing through that time, and assessed value goes down and starts the climb back. However, also the most pronounced in the graph is a decline in the tax rate. As you would see, it started in the 91, that's with Measure 5, and then with Measure 50 again, and it just kept it steady at about 15 point something from that point on.
Mazen?
Yes.
That number on the rate, this includes bonded indebtedness then as well?
Yes,
so that's why it's above. That's why it looks like it's scooting above $15.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Otherwise, without the bonded indebtedness under Measure 5, we would be at 15, just on a flat line basis.
Mr. Chair, we could probably be below 15.
Yeah.
Because not everybody
right, that's, yeah,
taxes
point.
To that maximum rate that they could. In general, this is how the picture looks as the growth of the imposed levies. And what this graph is telling you is how the split between the different entities that collect and benefit from the tax and you would see how the K through 12 and ESDs have come to an almost a dip down in the mid 90s. And started taking a lot less percentage of the total tax, and cities and counties came to take a little more of that, and the other districts as well. Those are in the green on the top. So that's the difference in the composition of who is getting the tax. Now, of course, an important thing is who levies the taxes on property. And of course, we said that it's all local governments and local districts. And in general, in Oregon, we have about 1,400 taxing districts. Those are both educational and government from all different classifications. Now, you think about that staggering number of 1,400 districts, and about 800 of those districts are special districts, basically. About 60%. These are fire, police, libraries, cemeteries, water, and so on. And 17% of all these districts are cities. Of course, you know that we have about 258 cities in the state of Oregon, and that's why you have that number. And 14% are K to 12. That's about 200 school districts, basically. And of course, not one thing to keep in mind, not all districts have taxing authorities. Some cities don't, and some districts don't. They exist as a district, but they don't actually levy taxes. Now, the important thing that needs to be known when we do property taxation and assessment is which property is taxed. And generally, the property that is taxed is the real property, as we call it. This is real, and also the personal property. Well, personal property, this is buildings, structures, equipment, but this is not your furniture at home, basically, or your tools at home. These are for the businesses and for large institutions. Merchandise, furniture. Some intangible personal property is also taxed. An intangible personal property is something that you cannot hold or have or move. These would be something like the airline slots in the airport and so on, because these are assessed on income. If you break this whole picture down into what is taxed and what brings the most out of the total property taxation, you see that real property is the lion's share of that. It's about 90%, 89% of total. Personal property, about 4%. Manufactured structures, these are also called mobile homes, about 1%. And utilities, about 6% of the total. Now, also with the changes that we went through in the 90s, one thing that was always interesting to watch is the switch between the residential and non-residential property and how much they make up out of the total tax picture. The top line in the early years, that is the pinkish, help me with the colors here, pinkish? Yeah, it's pinkish. That one used to be the non-residential property. The one with the triangles, the blue in the bottom, that is the residential property. And you see they meet at a certain point in the early 90s, and then residential just basically takes off and surpasses and becomes the dominant section. This is a more segregated look of the assessed value by property class. You'd see that residential now, that is a further refinement in real property and non-real. The residential is about 49% or 50% of the total. And then you would have multifamily and the commercial about 17% as the biggest one, second biggest. The utilities at 6%, and then the personal at about 4%. It's always fascinating to me, at least, when you look at the geographic segregation in the state by county, is which counties actually have the biggest share of the property. And you would see that the three counties on top basically make up about 47% of the total. And the counties in yellow, those about four counties, two of them in the middle, make about 24.5%. And the four other counties are highlighted make about 11%. These about 11, 12 counties basically make up about 84-85% of the total assessed value in the state. The rest of the counties make the rest. And what has been growing the most out of value, you would see that residential property, it is, as you remember when we saw in the graph, that makes 49% of the total. Yet with that big of a base, it is still growing at the highest level. That's at 8.9%. Now remember, a bigger base grows with a lot huger number than a smaller one. So when you have growth of 8.9, which is higher than the total of 8.7, you're finding a big growth base. And this would slide would contrast the assessed value. The first one that I showed you was basically the assessed value. This is what we call the real market value growth rates. And it shows through the 90s, or the decade of between 1990 and 2000, of what is the percentage of growth that we have seen in around the state in property real market value. And you see almost all the middle section, the one that is in funky, what is that color?
Purple?
Funky purple, yes.
Funky purple.
That's about 10% growth or more per year, and that's very healthy.
Wow.
And of course, the one in the bottom about 3-6%. I mean 6-10%, and the yellow, which is only the two counties on top, between 3-6, which is the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
Now we dive into an overview of the combinations of Measure 5 and Measure 50 and what they have basically done. Now, this is a quick example of what a property tax bill would be. When you have a taxpayer of $167,340, every taxpayer gets an ID. Basically, this is the smallest unit of operation that you would have to be identified with. So everybody has a tax ID number, and everybody belongs in a code area. Two things you would see always on the property tax bill is the real market value. In this example, it's $150,000, and then assessed value at $125,000. Then you'd have a list of taxes that comes through taxing district, K through 2 through 12 school taxes. At 575 ESD, and you total community college tax, that's 75 CC, that signifies. You will have a total education tax at about $750. And then the government, as we mentioned before, taxes are classified into either educational or government. The government taxes will be the county tax, the city tax, the fire district, the library tax, and those sum up to about 900. Now, outside of all of these, of course, you have the general obligation bonds. And if you have general obligation bonds of 125, that gets added on top of the total tax bill for this particular example, 1650. Now, the components of that tax system, basically, as in that example that we have shown, that everybody gets a tax number. Everybody gets a number, an identifier. This is the tax ID. So if you think of a neighborhood, each house in the neighborhood would have an ID number. Now, the second level of organization or aggregation in that would be the code area. The code area would include a number of lots or a number of tax IDs. And each code area is unique. So if you think about the whole county, the county is sliced into a number of code areas. Okay. Property, real and market values is, of course, the market value is the minimum amount that will be fixed in the market between informed buyers and sellers. That's what typically one would either pay or receive for the sale of the property. The assessed value is the value of the property that is being subjected to the taxation. This is what the tax look at when figure the taxes is the assessed value. And that basically what came with Measure 50, as we will go in more details on it later. And then the tax amount for each district is, each district could span a number of area codes or code areas. Now, each district could overlap over another district. They, let's say a city and a county, of course they overlap on their tax district. However, sometimes school districts would overlap with other districts, such as city district. They might not encompass the whole city, but certain parts of it. So the tax district are superimposed on the county or the code areas in order to make the ability to organize the taxation. So the building blocks, basically, they look in a sense of the lowest level of organization is an account, as we said. And these accounts are put into code areas. These code areas are taxed by the taxing districts, and then those taxing districts exist in counties. And of course, this whole thing is part of the state.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier you had mentioned that some cities did not have taxing authority, and I assume that's true with other taxing districts. My question is, what determines whether or not a taxing district or a city does have taxing authority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, the at a certain time before Measure 50, governing body of a taxing district would have levied the taxes. After Measure 50, there would be a need for voter approval for a taxing district to start levying tax if it hasn't levied taxes before. Let's, for an example, if a city, a small city, exists and it never levied taxes, and it chooses to start doing that, it could start by first asking the voters and then start levying or establishing what's so-called a permanent tax rate. Now, if it had done that in the past and stopped, and then is trying to do that again, unfortunately, it will have difficulty. There was a ballot measure of this election that was voted down that would not permit the cities who had in the past levied taxes to be able to do it again. So if they've existed always before Measure 50 and they were levying taxes, Measure 50 came and gave everybody a permanent tax rate. you didn't have a permanent tax rate at the time of Measure 50, then the idea would be looked whether you ever had it before or you were new and you want to establish something.
Who looks at it to determine? Does the city itself or the taxing district make that decision, or does the state or some other organization make the decision whether they can impose that on themselves and become a taxing district?
Mr. Chair, the President of the Office, the taxing district, if the governing body of the taxing district, let's say as in the city council, comes to the idea that we need to start levying taxes, it could start the process by basically putting forward the services that the city would be providing with those taxes, and then start the process of going to the voters in the district that it exists in.
I see.
Okay. Now, what Measure 5 has done, Measure 5, basically the key elements of it, that it has, Measure 5, of course, as you know, was first implemented in the 91-92. It became law in the Constitution in 91, and 91-92 tax year was the first year that it implemented. And Measure 5, it still looks at properties with the real market value. And those real market value puts a cap on how much you would be able to tax per $1,000 of the real market value, and established two limits, the $5 for the education and the $10 for government. However, the education was gradually went into rather than one time. It was gone to the $5 over the period of 3 years at that time. And the Constitution that was amended by Measure 5 permits the code area limits, so it limits it by code area. However, since Measure 50 came in, it requires that the limits of Measure 5 be implemented property by property. And also Measure 5 limits the total amount of taxes on individual property. This is with the amendment of Measure 5, as we mentioned. This is the $5 per 1,000 of real market value for schools, and non-schools or government is a limit, $10,000 per 1,000 of real market value. So your total limit would be $15 per 1,000. And this is where you're ceiling, basically. As a taxing district, choose not to go all the way to the ceiling, or you might not need that ceiling, and therefore the total tax rate, if it was only based on Measure 5, probably on the aggregate would look like less than $15. When Measure 50 came in, it established values and rate limits, and the Measure 50 basically became an amendment in May 1997, and it was a replacement proposed by the Legislative Assembly to replace Measure 47, which was having difficulties and legal problems. And it basically took out all the levying process and the continuing levies. It also provided tax relief, and it started using the rate and the value limit. Now, the rate basically established permanent rates for all taxing districts that existed at that time. It was taken to be the permanent rates for all the taxing districts. Now, it also allows the voters to levy what's so-called the local options with a double majority. And the local option is the difference, if you will, between the Measure 50 limits that was established as permanent limits and the Measure 5. So if you're a group of governments in a county or in an area and you have not reached the $10 per 1,000, And at the same time, you have limits established by Measure 5 that are a lot lower. You have that difference that you could go to the voters for by the local option levy.
Minister, if I can, one of the things we've seen with local options, you discussed earlier how these limits apply on a property by property basis under Measure 50. And so one of the things we've seen in local options is one of the problematic aspects of local options is that you can pass a local option on a district, but the gap may vary by property as to just how much you can collect. So that constrained to some extent the usefulness of local options, because it's difficult to predict exactly how much you're going to raise.
Mr. Chair, this is correct. If a group of properties are within the same number of districts, that problem probably will not
right.
exist. But there is an overlap in
That's
districts
right.
all the
Different
time.
Code areas.
Right. Within. Now, this is an interesting look on if we have only continued with Measure 5 limits and not have Measure 50, the taxes to be collected on property would be the yellow line on top. As you see, since the introduction of Measure 50 in 97, that line have just went down by that much. If in the way I estimated this from that time of implementation until 2002, if we were only dealing with Measure 5 limits, there would have been about $3.9 billion more in taxes. That's about $800 million a year, more than what Measure 50 allows. Now, the Measure 50, basically what it did in a nutshell is about bring the property taxes about 17% down on a statewide level. And the way it has done that is in 1997-98, it took the property values and rolled them back to the 1995-96 values, and I said if you have a property in that year at the market value of 1995-96, this is what the 1997-98 value would be. In addition, you reduce it by 10% more. What it has done is basically rolled it back in time and then took 10% more out of that value. And that's where the introduction of the assessed value at that time. And it basically made a very clear distinction between what a market value and an assessed value is. So they no longer are the same. The market value still goes on. Remember, it's 10% more of 2 years ago. Now, there's a value limit, the value in 1998 value of property, assessed value is allowed also by Measure 50 to grow about 3% per year, unless the exception, or we call it the exception values, is there are significant new improvements to the property. And those exceptions to as new improvement, the types would be something like new construction, subdivisions, omitted properties, rezoning, loss of exemption. This is if it's a farm exempt property and it loses its farm exemption. So the value set, for example, for a new construction, it would be a ratio of similar properties that exist in that area or similar geographic location, and they would take the ratio between the real market value and the assessed value and apply it to the new construction. Now, however, there's another type of improvement, which is minor constructions, and that is defined in statutes 308149, and it exempts the minor improvements that do not exceed 10,000 or 25,000 over the 5-year period from being added to the assessed value. So, in graphic example, let's say you have a new construction, a home that is being constructed, and it sells in the market. It has a real market value of about 150,000. You would look at something that is similar in the area and see that its real market value, let's say 200,000. You take one number of examples and apply to it, and you find that its assessed value is about 160,000. You take another example, and it's 100,000 real market value, but its assessed value is 60,000. And a third example of 150,000 to 130,000 assessed value. So your average ratio of assessed to real market value in that class is about 78%. So your real market value of 150,000 of your new constructed home would fetch an assessed value of about 117,000.
And that begins the floor for your 3% growth under
the 3% growth measure under 50. The measure 50.
If you can go back to that, this I guess points up some of the, I think what we call the horizontal inequity under Measure 50. You've got then new construction at 150,000 being taxed on an assessed value of 117,000 because it's based on the average, whereas you've got a property already existing with a value of 150 that, by virtue of the fact that it's not new construction but came in through the rate being reset under Measure 50, is being taxed at an assessed rate of 130,000. So they're going to pay different amounts of tax even though they have the same real market value.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. These are one of the
And these could be homes. These could be homes two doors next door to each other.
And they definitely could.
Yeah.
Yes. That ratio that we've just talked about, Mr. Chair, in different classes of property is a little different for a residential and multi-home properties is about 77.6%. This is as of the year 2001-2002, and the commercial is about 64.3%. The total of the state about 76.6%. That's a ratio of we're looking at this point. Now the Measure 50 also established what's so-called the maximum assessed values. And what the maximum assessed values are basically the greater of 103%, and here's where the 3% increase, of your prior year assessed value, plus, of course, any exception values, which is the remodeling or the rezoning, change in property line or so on. Now, or it is 100% of the prior year's maximum assessed value. And why is it, or when does it become only 100% rather than 103%? That's when there's no space or no difference, if you will, between your market assessed and market value, real market value, and the maximum assessed value. In other words, your assessed value can never exceed your market value. Once you get to that point, it's a plateau, and it's going to be the maximum assessed value the same.
So if you're in a situation where the real market value is declining, your maximum assessed value will not cross that decline in the real market value and end up at a rate higher than the real market value.
Precisely. Now there are also special assessment, especially assessed value. Those are values that are assessed less than what the full assessment would be. They set these properties to be taxed under the Measure 5, and those are basically a special assessment for farm, forest properties, and many other specially assessed properties that are allowed in the statutes. Now, the Measure 50 value still maintain the Measure 5 value as we 5 and 50. We should find two different names for these. Mm-hmm. 5 and 50. Call it X and Y. Okay. That new term that you would see used over and over again, and so it'll be introduced to it. So when it comes up again, the Measure 5 value you'll find occasionally referred to a Measure 5 value. This is always to be the real market value of the property. Now, for specially assessed properties, the Measure 5 value is a specially assessed value, which is much reduced, if you will. Tax rates. Those tax rates are were permanently established by Measure 5, by Measure 50. What's not in a permanent rate? Now, remember that Measure 50 came and said, if you are a taxing district that have a certain amount of levies that you are putting on the property, these will be transformed into permanent rates. However, there are things that are outside that rate that you still have some flexibility with, which is the local option levies that we've talked about. The Portland Police and Fire Pension, and that you would find referred to in many documents and so on as the gap bonds. And then the general obligation bonds, those are outside the limit, basically. Well, what a permanent rate does and what it can do, the any district that exists and has a permanent rate, it basically cannot increase those permanent rates. That permanent rate basically is fixed. The non-schools could impose less than the permanent rate based on your needs, and you don't have to reach all your full taxing authority. The new taxing districts, if you establish a new taxing district, just like we were talking a while ago, you can establish new permanent rates, but you have to be a new taxing district. That means brand new, that you have not existed before. And in the case that two districts merge, and they think that through merger they could provide better services, more efficiencies, or what have you, those two districts that merge will end up having in total the same combined rate, if you will. They figure out how much in revenue they're getting, transform it back into a rate, and they will have the same combined basic permanent rate.
Representative Bridger.
I'm not sure I understand that. Would you explain that a little bit to me?
Sure. If you have two districts, let's say there are two water districts or two different districts that they think through merger that they could provide better, more efficient service. They agree on merger. In Measure 50, which is in the Constitution at this point, they would the way they would figure their new permanent rate, they both have, each would have a permanent rate to start right. with. In order to figure their new permanent rate, they will go and take that permanent rate, apply it to the assessed value, and assess how much revenue is being grazed by each district on its own. And combine that revenue and mathematically transform it back into a rate per thousand. And that will be the new permanent rate unified for both districts.
Mr. Chair, the point that I don't understand is that if two districts combine and they have the new permanent rate, they're looking at exactly the same revenue that they had before they combined.
Aggregated, yeah, mm-hmm. between the two districts. So if you've got one that's raising $5 million at 20 cents per thousand and another one that's raising $5 million at 50 cents per thousand, the new rate would be whatever would be required spread across the board to raise $2 million.
That's correct.
So somewhere between those two rates.
That's correct.
Probably.
Yes. That would be the new permanent
rate
combined.
What then would be the advantage of the combining of the two districts?
I assume probably service or administrative benefits. It wouldn't be the tax rate benefit. That would be a function of the merger. The merger would probably be driven by, let's say, administration or service or mm-hmm. whatever other
reduced cost.
External, yeah, whatever external needs there might be out there.
Okay. All right. I understand. All right. Thank you very much.
Or a change in the statute.
Could be. Something external, usually. This just gets to how that rate is established once you've made the decision to do it.
That's true. Also, one more thing about the rate. If, let's say, a property exists outside the taxing district and that property is being annexed to this taxing district, the same existing rate, existing permanent rate, is extended to this annexed property. So it's not a new or a different rate. And through the Measure 50, of course, the voters approved levies. And the local option are the levies outside the permanent rate. And they need to be approved either in a general election or an election with a majority or a double majority with 50% turnout. There are two types of local options. The first one is the operating levies, and those are levies for operation of the functions of the district, and those are limited to 5 years. And then the capital levies, which are limited to the useful life of the asset or 10 years. Levies can be rate or levy based, which means you either levy so on per thousand or an amount of money. And it's still, however, subject to the cap of Measure 5. That's the $5 per thousand for schools or for education and $10 per thousand for government. The school local option came in 1999 legislative session. House Bill 2753 allowed K-12 district to seek voter approval for local option taxes. That was not true before. And about 14 school districts have received voter approval for that local option since then. It seems like more and more school districts are exercising that option. Since Measure 50, of course, that also was in Measure 50, unlike the local option for schools, that community colleges could make up what they have lost from going to a permanent rate under Measure 50 and make that cut by levying a local option.
I like the way you've cut that line.
Yes. That was by design, Mr. Chair.
By design.
The general obligation bonded debt is exempt from Measure 50 limits. This is outside the Measure 50. So you could actually get a bond indebtedness without having to live within the Measure 50 limits. However, it still must be approved in a general election of 50% turnout, and that's a double majority. And you can bond for 5-year public safety vehicles. General obligation bonds cannot be used for the following. It cannot be used for maintenance, regular maintenance at and repairs, or supplies, and so on. So, at the end, how does the Oregon property tax limit basically look like? If you think about it in this type of graphic, you have it in levies. The core of the tax limits are the permanent rates. And then, in addition to those, you would have the gap and pension, the local option, and the urban renewal special levies that we might have time to talk about later on. And all of these are bounded within the Measure 5 limit. All these exist, but they are still within the Measure 5 limit. The only thing that is outside the Measure 5 limit is the general obligation bond. Shall I do this again? I like this slide.
Very nice.
Now, the property tax imposed by district and tax source, this is in the tax year 2002. This is the tax year that I just finished. And you would see that the city colleges and counties and the total down for Oregon, with the cities living or collecting about $700 million, colleges $127 million, counties $618 million, and so on. And where the sources of those come from, whether they're bonds, local options, and permanent. The total, of course, as you would see for the state of Oregon, if you aggregate everything together, you'll get about $3.25 billion for that year. And if you look at this in a more precise manner, you would find that the permanent rate makes the bulk, or the spine, if you will, of the property tax system, at about 75% of the total. After that comes bonds, at about 15%. Local option is growing. It's at 4% now. Used to be smaller than that. And you could see that local options, since Measure 50, all the way from Measure 50 until today, is growing by about 57% a year. Every other growth that you would see is barely nudges the graph. Of course, bonds are growing also at 7.8. There's nothing to be complaining about, of course, but compared to 57%, that makes it look midget next to it.
Imagine, why do you show zero on your chart there at the bottom for K-12? You show zero growth rate under local option.
That's probably a misalignment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But the as the total is about 7.5, it seems. The total growth.
Total growth, yeah, for K-12. Right. But we have it because we have seen local options since Measure 50, so there would be some element of growth in there.
Right.
Okay.
There's actually a very pronounced growth on that.
Since we started with
none. Right.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been a long time. Mm-hmm. It's only since 1999, and it's growing quickly. Now, the Measure 50 tax calculation. Basically, the assessed value that we've talked about repeatedly is multiplied by each taxing district, permanent, local option, gap, urban renewal, special levy, and exempt bond rates. The tax rate is multiplied by that assessed value to get the tax. The total consolidated rate is a sum of the district's tax rate that impose that taxes on the property. And the school consolidated tax rate is a sum of the K-2, the ASD, and the community college taxes that will make all the education segment of taxes, and the government will be the sum of all non-school tax rates. And remember, those are still under the cap of Measure 5. So that's why we have the two classifications on. Now, the tax compression is something that will probably appear in many places and you'll hear about. And what the tax compression is basically a source of living to the caps of Measure 5. So if you have the Measure 5 tax, and you have that, of course, for $5 for schools, and then you'd have the $10 per for government. And if you sum all the school rates, and those school rates are higher than the five, then the compression occurs. Compression means you have to push down the tax rate all the way until you get back to the five. And in essence, you would be losing the amount of taxes, even though it was approved. You would still have to compress back to the Measure 5 limit. So for an example of that, let's say that the consolidated school rate is $5 in assessed value on 150,000 real market value home that has 130,000 assessed value, and your school Measure 5 rate is about 750. However, Measure 50 only gave you $650. Your school tax gap is 100. Tax gap amount is the difference between the 5 and the 50. But the school passes a local option levy of $1 per thousand on assessed value, because they remember that's the gap that they could make up. So they levy $1. What you end up with is a $780 in total. That's $650 in addition to the new local option levy. That $780 is slightly above the $750 that Measure 5 caps you at. So what happens is that you have to take out $30 of that total. And that $30 is what's referred to as the tax compression.
And Mazen, going back to what we talked about earlier about how a local option can have a different effect on a property by property basis, we talked about that in terms of code areas, but also going back to the example where new construction is coming online at a different assessed value than another piece of property maybe next door. That difference can actually occur on a property by property basis then.
That's true.
Yeah, so that on a local option you may be collecting one amount from house A and the next door neighbor, a different local option amount because of new construction or some other exception value that has changed the assessed value that they're being taxed at, even within the same code area.
Mr. Chair,
which makes this so devilish for districts to predict what they're going to be able to collect.
Yes, that's precisely true. However, it seems probably will not be your neighbor next door, because they will have all the same layers of districts that are taxing. It's most likely the neighbor that is two streets down that would have a difference between them. So the school districts, as a conclusion, get the $130 in extended, but they only collect $100, which $30 is basically the tax compression. So the tax compression occurs when the Measure 5 tax is less than the Measure 50 tax, in very simple terms. The amount of tax compression is the Measure 5 tax minus Measure 50 tax. And if the compression occurs, now remember, the local options get reduced first. And that includes all local options. So let's say the school districts have a local option and community college have a local option. If the total education amounts is above measure 5, compression occurs. Now, it does not occur only in the new local option. It occurs in all local options proportionately. So every, and local options goes first. Now, if we reduce all local options and we have not reached the $5 limit, then the permanent rate starts being reduced.
So you have a community college local option that's been out for a couple of years, and now the school district, the K-12 district, passes a local option that forces compression. They both get reduced?
Yes.
And so the community college then is going to receive less in the later years of their local option than they received in the years when they didn't have that competition with the K-12 district.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Well, this graph might not do justice to the amounts of compression that have occurred, but this basically tried to put it in percentage terms of school, non-school, school and government. And you would see that in the 94-95 and 95-96 and 97, almost 100% of all compression was occurring to schools. So the red part of the bar is the percentage that the schools' compression out of total compression. In the numbers in the bottom is the amounts in millions, basically, of that amount of compression. So in the 96-97, the amount of compression for schools was 1.38 billion. The year after, it's 12. If you put it in a graph, that probably won't show, but the most compression you would see came in the first years of the implementation of Measure 5. Now, compression is creeping back up, more to schools than non-schools, but basically schools are being compressed the most. So the number of taxing, what actually affects the local option gap amount, size, and growth is what you have as a real market and assessed value. So if you have a higher real market, or the real market is growing much faster, remember the assessed value grows only by 3%. So if you, that gap is increasing faster, so you could actually have a room or space between the two gaps to levy a bigger option, local option, than you would have otherwise. And then the size of the permanent tax rate. If the permanent tax rate is high enough that it almost reaches the Measure 5 gap, you don't have enough space between the two caps, and vice versa, of course. Other tax rates subject to Measure 5 limits also intervene in that. The amount of residential property in proportions to all other property classes, and the amount of the compression, the current compression, and the presence of the urban renewal districts. The other features of the property tax system, one thing to keep in mind, that the January assessment date, and it is a July 1st lien date, so basically you have almost aligned with fiscal years type of arrangements. And the tax statements are mailed about October 25th. It have changed from the previous requirements that used to be on the six-year appraisal cycle. And taxpayers could appeal either or both market value or assessed value. And each appeal, depending on where it comes, can change different things at different times. If you are appealing assessed value, that brings down, of course, the whole rates. If you're appealing Measure 5, that, remember, you're almost appealing the options and so on that could exist between the two
cats. Shall we keep going to urban renewal, or can we?
Well, let me see. Yeah,
it's the chair. It's up to you.
I say briefly, and that almost doesn't make any sense. But by the same token, I don't know any other time that we've set aside to come back to urban renewal. This is one that committee it probably bears hearing a couple times. So imagine if you want to try and do it this morning, give us the first overview, and then when we get back to anything dealing with urban renewal, we'll probably need another orientation at that point again, just because of, if you all thought this was complex so far, you ain't seen nothing yet. Go ahead and take us to urban renewal, man.
Okay. Mr. Chair, urban renewal is a very fun subject, actually.
I get graduate credit for that.
Graduate credit, that's right. He's gone from property tax 101 to property tax 400.
If you need coffee, it's the time to take it now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, maybe we should ask for CLE credit.
Okay, well, the basics for urban renewal. Basically, urban renewal is an old program. It was established as a constitutional amendment back in the 60s. The goal of the urban renewal is just to improve the blighted areas in Oregon, in the cities and counties, find a way to be able to fund them and sustain them and help them through the property tax. And what that goes through is a formation of urban renewal agency and plans. And those don't really need voter approval. All urban renewal taxes must be used to pay for the loans and the debt. And as of this year, there is about 40 urban renewal agencies and about 58 urban renewal plans in the state.
As in, urban renewal agencies are formed, or maybe you're going to get to it, formed by?
They're basically formed by a bigger governing body of a county, not a city. And so.
Mm-hmm. Right, or by intergovernmental agreement,
right.
Between cities and counties or city.
If we look at the state in general, this is how it looks. The counties in yellow would have one urban renewal agency, one urban renewal plan. There's only one, as you see. Slightly Multnomah, one urban renewal agency and seven urban renewal plans. And ones in blue are two urban renewal agencies, two to four urban renewal plans. And then the three urban renewal agencies, three or more plans. And finally, five urban renewal agencies. So only two and five more, five or more urban renewal plans. How does urban renewal work in very simple terms is when an urban renewal agency is formed, all the property, if you will, in the urban renewal district that it was established, all the values are frozen, like frozen in time, if you will. Let's assume that we established urban renewal today. We will go to this area that we declared as an urban renewal boundaries, and we say all the property values in that urban renewal is it. This is not going to be changed anymore. However, in reality, of course, things change and increase. The difference between that frozen level and the increase above that level is what we call the access. And incremental change, all the property taxes that come out of that increment between the frozen and the what is actually occurring, the property taxes on that is what becomes the urban renewal agency's revenue. Is that?
So far.
Okay. Measure 50 distinguishes between existing urban renewal plans and new urban renewal plans. And the existing ones, when December 6, 96, that's when the Measure 50 took it to be, they actually were given a tax authority and a permanent rate, primarily, just like everybody else.
Mazen, if you can go back just a second. We're again kind of approaching the one of the surreal elements. We have existing, I mean, existing urban renewal plans, that's a term of art. That's not just a, I mean, that defines a certain category or a certain group of urban renewal plans.
And Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Because we have urban renewal plans online after December 1996 that are existing, but that are not existing urban renewal plans. So, committee, we've got to keep that in mind, that existing urban, keep quotation marks around existing urban renewal plans, or else you get lost.
It depends what is, Mr. Chair.
Which is how we get to non-existing urban renewal plans that in fact exist, but they weren't defined as existing because they weren't in existence before December 6th of 1996.
I could not have said it better myself.
So, if I understand correctly, Mr. Chair, what you're really saying is existing urban renewal plans is a shortcut to say existing urban renewal plans as of December 6, 1996.
It seemed to make sense in December 96 to call them existing. Since then, it doesn't seem to make so much sense. But yeah, that
okay.
As when they existed as of that time. So as we've mentioned a few minutes ago, that the taxes generated from that increment of value, that is one of the main sources of revenue, and that's what we call the division of tax. Now, it used to be that the portion for the division of tax above and beyond that limit, whether it's school or government or bonds, goes to the Urban Renewal Agency. However, this is not true anymore. At this point, after a court case, the school portion of the taxes are no longer considered for the urban renewal because they are meant to be, as the court case explains it, those are government taxes and they should not be considered against the $5 limit, Measure 5 cap that was established.
That was a question I had.
Urban renewal taxes are divided, the court area, urban renewal value is not allocated to individual accounts. The agency's share in tax compression losses also from the division of tax. So if tax compression occurs, it occurs proportionately. So let's take an example and see if we make that any easier. Let's say that there is assessed value for the cord area that the urban renewal that exists in at about $200 million, and the excess assessed value, which is the difference between the frozen time and what we have encountered at the time of the new assessment, is about $16
million. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
A quick question. When an urban renewal district is sunsetted, what happens to the tax increment at that point? Does it then work against the ceiling?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I asked this question when I first came to this job, and they told me...
They told me.
Don't worry about it. Well, I think it's going to happen soon in Eugene.
Okay. Now, we haven't seen it yet.
Get ready.
Well, I'll look into that more. Okay. I think, basically, if it goes away, logic would say that the whole assessed value would go back to where things should have been. So, because what the urban renewal have done is frozen value.
Mm-hmm. Once the value is not frozen, it all goes back all to being classified as government and schools.
And the money then taxes is then divided among the constituent districts under the 5 and 50 limits.
Right. Yeah, that's what appears to be.
So
if it's an 8%, that's 16 million. The total school operation, and I left the school segment here just to show how that is different at this point, because the change have not occurred too long ago. So if you're talking about $1 million for schools, 80,000 of that, which is 8%, will be going to the urban renewal. That's before the court ruling. And then the what's left is the 920,000 that will basically go to school or to the education.
But under current law,
in current law, it'll be back to the full million. Now the total government is about 1.5 million, and 8% of that is about 120,000. So the division of tax, if you will give the governments about 1,380,000. Bonds are about 500,000. Urban renewal gets 40,000, leaves about 460. Then you go back and add all those, and $240,000 is what the urban renewal gets.
Representative Virgil.
Yes. In order to continue, urban renewal districts must remain in debt. Otherwise, if they are out of debt, then that district is going to go away. Is that right?
Representative Virgil, I think that's basically true. The urban renewal revenue is to pay for indebtedness.
Yes.
As the data that I would have from 98-2000, this shows revenues from division of taxes for the urban renewals and plans. This also is before the time where the education and left it there to show that there was a big segment of the education amounts that was going to urban renewal. Now that doesn't mean that all that money will go back to the education. Now remember, the education districts have figured out that there is a sort of urban renewal take out of their total taxes. So the levy was at a certain level. Now, if they don't need, and that's probably an if they don't need that amount, they don't have to recover it. Now, there is also a source that the urban renewal could get, and this was established with Measure 50, that they could get a special levy. That's just like a local option, if you will, for urban renewal. And this was given to the existing, and those were the existing rather than the new existing urban renewal. Those are the ones in 1996. That could be used to supplement revenue, and it is spread over all property. Special levy taxes appear on property tax statements. And how the special levy comes is, remember that since Measure 50 that was established for the urban renewal districts, permanent rate too. The permanent rate is called their maximum tax authority, and what they get over the division of tax, what is left, you would have a gap, if you will, and that gap it could be filled with a special levy.
And that doesn't take voter approval to fill that gap.
Right.
Those special levies can be imposed by the urban renewal authority itself.
Because they have that.
Right, because they have the authority, right. Oh, here we have the first appearance of the non-existing UR plans, which in fact do exist. But
that's true.
But only in your mind.
But only in your mind. Off with their heads.
It's basically put to the maximum tax authority minus a division of taxes. That gives you the special levy. And they have to go through still the process to certify for the tax assessor that the portion what they want for that special levy. And also Measure 50 gave urban renewal districts three options to go with. Those three options basically says you get a permanent rate, and you could choose to have both division of tax plus special levy up to your limit. And then the second option would be that you don't get division of tax and you get special levy for the whole amount. And the third one, which was chosen by the minority of urban renewal, which is the fixed amount for both the division of tax and the special levy. New plans have only one choice, which is 100% division of tax. That's the new existing urban renewal. And quickly, what were the revenue or the division of tax and special levies for urban renewal revenues come, and you see that there's a certain level of fluctuation. You can not necessarily have a trend in each one of these two, but in the total amount of revenue, you would see a trend of increase. However, it is important to see that not the full maximum taxing authority for the urban renewal districts was utilized all the time. Actually, for more years than not, the maximum tax authority was not all used. The blue band in the graph shows the amount that are not used of that authority. And finally, the urban renewal taxes grew by about 55% in 97-98 because of the existing urban renewals could use more of the maximum tax authority now. And taxes from the urban renewal special levies can have wide variations annually, just for many reasons. One of them is compression and the need and so on. The year 2000, the amount of unused tax authority grew by about 30%. Urban renewal division of tax grows from growth in access values as well as new voter-approved tax levies. Of course, the exception is the seven urban renewal agencies that chose to go 100% with the division of tax. And since Measure 50, urban renewal total taxes have grown annually at about 4%, but urban renewal maximum tax authority has grown by 12% because of the growth in values, of course. And with that, I'll say that we've done urban renewal.
All right. For the first time. Representative Bridger.
Yes. This is a little bit on the expenditure side, but it does impact the tax revenue side on urban renewal, and that is that the plan, you cannot spend any of the tax revenue on anything that is not in the urban renewal plan, and you cannot change the urban renewal plan without going to the voters.
The area?
To the area, mm-hmm. to change it. So that the taxes for it often are viewed by the public as being all right because they have a list of things that only can be spent on that tax revenue. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's true. They have a constrained geography to them and limits that they would wear and how they spend that.
But also that relates to one of the tensions that we have, isn't it, though, that you may be in a taxing district but not within the urban renewal district. And so you're...
Isn't that we had in... Is it Bandon? So that your taxes, oh, help me out. You are within the geographic confines of the taxing district, but not within the urban renewal district, and but your taxes nevertheless are funding the
right.
the
you
plan.
You still pay for the urban renewal,
right.
Because you're within a defined area. Don't necessarily get the payments
right.
from or the expenditures from the urban renewal because you're not within the urban renewal
right.
definition.
Right. So we'll hear about that from time to time too. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Again, trust me, as we get into bills in particular that may be specific to any of these issues, we will spend some time reorienting because this does bear repetition. This is graduate level stuff here that I don't think anyone expects us to get on one overview, but you got to start somewhere. So this is it. These are good materials. We had a request to have these hard copies reprinted in a little bit larger size, either fewer slides per page or maybe enlarged. I think it's a good request because there's a lot of detail and small print on that, and I do want members to feel encouraged to look at these during quiet moments to refresh the overview that we've gotten here. So we will try and get them back to you a little bit easier on the eye. And to Paul, looking into tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, tomorrow we have a discussion of excise taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Cigarette tax, of course, we've had a significant increase. We'll talk about that. You have some legislation in that area. Talk a little bit about gasoline taxes, beer and wine taxes. And then on Thursday, we've got an overview of school finance. And then on Friday, we will have the Revenue Option School Funding and Accountability Task Force report ready for you. And some we've invited some members of the Advisory Council to talk about that, as well as the members of the task force itself.
So, more fun to plan for. Appreciate everybody's attendance this morning. We are adjourned.